From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with the passage of the New York State budget earlier this year. Included in the bills were new election rules, which the Gotham Gazette has said could be a, quote, poison pill for several political parties, not Republicans or Democrats. The rules have to do with ballot thresholds for political parties, which go into effect this year. Previously, in order for parties to automatically gain a ballot line, their gubernatorial candidates had to receive 50,000 votes each four-year cycle. Well, now that number is 130,000 votes, or 2% of votes cast, whichever is greater, every 2 years in gubernatorial or presidential elections. Third-party officials and members pushed back on the Public Campaign Financing Commission's rules, with the Working Families Party and the Conservative Party filing a lawsuit. They won, but the state legislature's passage of the bill made the victory moot. A final report on the rules is due December 1st, and unless the legislature opts to hold a special session within 20 days of the report's release, that rule could become law. So what does this mean for third parties in New York State? Some say it's the end of it. Is it really? The data shows the Conservative Party is the only third party that has consistently been able to earn the number of votes required under these new rules in order to appear or stay on the ballot. Do the Working Families Party, the Green Party, and the Libertarian Party face what could amount to extinction in this state? Our guests join us to talk about the new rules, what's fair, third parties this year, and what happens next. I'd like to welcome them now. The director of the Working Families Party in New York is Xochitl Nemeca. Xochitl, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Alex White is a member of the Green Party and a former candidate for office. Alex, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Welcome to Lauren Hall, a member of the Libertarian Party and associate professor of political science at RIT. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Great to be
here. Xochitl, let me start with you. Your time is a little bit more limited, but when you look at these changing rules, New York State says that the reason for this is because we're going to be moving to a $100 million public financing system for elections. Every candidate who gets on the ballot would have access to taxpayer-funded campaign cash, potentially. And with multiple candidates on multiple lines, the program would be increasingly costly, so the rules have to change. Is that fair to you?
Well, thanks, Evan, first of all, for having us and be able to talk about the importance of voting on the Working Families Party line this fall. What we have seen is that this change in law was not a response to what voters were looking for. Voters have been consistently saying that they want more choice in our democracy and not less, and fusion and minor parties provide that opportunity. The campaign finance law that was passed is not intimately connected at all with this increase to party lines, to the ballot threshold. We see that even more clearly by the fact that public financing does not actually come into effect until many years after this higher ballot requirement was put into effect. The courts that reviewed this earlier also did not see a clearly connected rationale between the public financing requirements and the need to increase the limitations on third parties. We want a strong public finance system in New York, but that this connection was made to be a poison pill to limit progressive power, so we have a one or another situation, either good campaign financing or a robust third-party system. And ultimately, we need both of those things, and one should not come at the expense of the other.
Okay. Alex White, how do you see these new rules?
I actually think that the public financing section is part of this that should get a lot more scrutiny and a lot more criticism. That is their excuse for doing this, and yet the bill they passed is basically a money grab for incumbents and will discourage their being opponents in races. And I just do not understand how they, why we have not had a lot more discussion about how pernicious their public financing is. And being that that is the reason that they want to eliminate third parties and give people fewer choice, the net result of all of this will be fewer contested elections. And in the last 8 years, Monroe County has only had 43.2% of all elections contested. Do we really want less of that?
All right. Lauren Hall, how do you see it?
I actually support, to a certain degree, both of the things that have been said. I'm not an expert on this particular bill, but I think that what we see is, I am concerned about the structure of the public financing provision here. I'm also very concerned about the way that that was linked to or used as a justification to limit third-party activity on the ballot. So it seems to me like you have a sort of potentially problematic public financing justification being used to even further limit Democratic voters' options when it comes to state ballots. And we know for a fact, again, looking at how the commission was set up and in the kinds of decisions that were made, this seems to be heavily politically motivated. This is not what voters want. It doesn't represent the actual diversity of political opinions on the ground in New York State. And it will have an enormous impact on political parties' ability to build a deep bench for elections moving forward, which will have enormous effects on those third parties, not just in local and state elections, but in obviously the federal elections as well.
Well, let me ask all three of you what you see as the aims and the goals of candidates who are on third party lines. And I don't say that in a way that says, well, you know, third parties can't or don't win. I don't really believe in that. When someone is on the ballot, they are invited for an interview on this program when we're talking politics. We don't spend a whole lot of time on, you know, sort of analyzing polls, et cetera. But at the same time, when we look at working families and Green, there's very different goals here. Jesse Lenny, who's done some work for the Working Families Party, has told us that they often, not always, but often haven't run working families candidates on, you know, just a working families line. They generally are endorsing or sort of working with Democrats, trying to push Democrats further to the left. In other words, trying to convince voters to vote for the quote-unquote Democrat on the WFP line in an effort to get their policies more progressive. Whereas the Green Party views itself as pretty distinct and different from Democrats and wants to run and win elections. Libertarians, the same. They're not Republican light. They're not Democrat light. Their goal is very different, and their goal is to win. Xochitl, how do you see that? I mean, generally, is it important to have a WFP line, even if you don't have a distinct WFP candidate?
Absolutely. We have our party functions on many different tactics, right? The ballot line is one tactic that allows us to make the difference in key races, for example, Anthony Brindisi, in places where moderate voters are looking for certain values and are more likely to support someone on the Working Families Party line than on the Democratic Party line. And it's helped us create a Democratic majority and to get more Democrats in Congress, for example. The ballot line has served an even more progressive role, for example, in downstate races where Diana Richardson and Letitia James, right, won as WFP line-only candidates, clearly distinguishing themselves from the Democratic nominee. And in the primaries, as Jesse Lenny alluded to, our role is to ensure that the most progressive Democrat emerges from the primary and actually becomes the person in office. In a state right now that's basically one-party rule, it's important for our party to distinguish between Democrats who stand with working people and Democrats who stand with corporate interests. And we use all of these tactics, the ballot line, primary systems, base building, to ensure we can build a New York that actually works for working people.
Do you get the sense that this administration with Governor Cuomo in New York State has been hostile to the WFP and to third parties generally, Xochitl?
We have had a very successful run here pushing on progressive issues, whether it was the $15 minimum wage, whether it was pushing on public financing for a long time, whether it's paid sick leave. And it's no secret that we have tension, right? And we are on different sides with the governor because fundamentally we're pushing against an austerity budget. And so the party's role is to ensure that the state does not leave any of our communities behind. And we are aggressive in our aims in that way.
Alex White, I ask this question with respect. When you have run in the past for various offices in Rochester, are you running because you intend and believe you will win? Or are you running because you think it's important to try to push certain candidates in different directions based on policy?
I would love to win. But my races are about ideas. I mean, and that's one of the big things that third parties bring to the table. And locally, I mean, we have gotten LED lights in our street lights, which was an idea that I floated and actually had to fight for. The body cameras on police officers, which has had some really good results and allowed there to be some transparency in the police department. You know, my opponents universally said it's never going to happen. And I don't think that idea would have seen the light of day without a candidate promoting it and bringing it to the forefront of the people of Rochester. And, you know, a bigger one that I can point to is the Green New Deal. I mean, the Green Party came up with that more than a decade ago, and it was fleshed out by Jill Stein and by Howie Hawkins, and, you know, the Democrats have now kind of tried to take parts of it over. And again, I don't think we would have had the movement without the Green Party bringing it to the attention of people. And, you know, these are the ways that these are the ways we can get change in our community, because the entrenched parties are not so much interested in change, improvement, making things better. They're very much based in the status quos. And so focusing on things that we really need to do, like energy efficiency, green initiatives, anti-poverty ideas, are things that really do not normally get much attention in the mainstream parties.
Lauren Hall, do you see it similarly with the ideas and the themes that libertarians tend to push in their races? And perhaps, I don't ask the question disrespectfully. I certainly know third-party candidates want to win and intend to try to win and have won in various places and various levels across the country. But is your concern also that without third parties on the ballot, there's a much more narrow range of discussion of issues and ideas in these races?
Yes, I think that's a very serious problem. And I'll preface this by just saying I don't speak for the local or state Libertarian Party. But I think one of the really important things that that libertarian principles in particular, but third parties broadly bring to the table, is, again, this move, and this echoes a little bit of what I think Alex just said, that they can bring in a lot of these topics that are less safe, but that are, in fact, extremely important to voters. And so in politics, we often talk about these third rail topics, right, like reforming Social Security or doing various kinds of things that are necessary to balance the budget, or tackling criminal justice reform in an actual real way. And the parties, the mainstream parties, simply do not have the incentives to tackle the really difficult issues. And what I mean by the incentives is that any really difficult policy issues are going to alienate part of their base. And so this stability that the previous speaker just referred to, that's their incentive, right? Their incentive is not to rattle the status quo. But a lot of the really serious issues in justice, the really serious issues in access, a variety of the major issues that taxpayers and citizens are the most concerned about, are ones that two parties are not actually addressing. And so I think you absolutely need third parties to bring those issues to the fore. And I also think you need the third parties to add legitimacy, to sort of bring visibility to a lot of these issues, so that it doesn't just look like a sort of ragtag collection of random citizens, but that there is, in fact, a principled position behind these reforms, and that principled position takes the form of a political party.
Well, Tom writes to say, Evan, normally I would have patience for this kind of an argument, but not this year. Third parties this year threaten the most important election of our lifetimes, and we can't have that. So this is not the right time. That's from Tom. Okay, Sochi, you want to hit that? Tom says he may have sympathy for the viability of third parties on ballot lines, but this particular election year, he's got no patience for the conversation. What do you say, Sochi?
I agree with Tom that there's so much at stake this year, and that's why we're so lucky in New York that we're a fusion voting state, and you can vote to defeat Donald Trump on our ballot line. When you vote on the WFP line for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, that vote does not spoil. That vote goes towards their total. And what allows people to do is stand at the United Front to defeat Donald Trump, but also ensure that we're sending a message that New York needs so much more, right? We can vote our values in a real way, and that's why those third parties and fusion voting means that voters have real choice and a real active role to play in our democracy, and are not just merely choosing a candidate, they're also choosing a platform and a value statement.
Well, and before I let you go, because I know your time's limited, and I will have both Alex and Lauren weigh in on that, on Tom's email, in just a moment. But what else do you say, Xochitl, to those who are maybe endorsing New York State's new rules on third parties, who would say, look, if you can't meet, you know, 2% or 130,000 votes, then you haven't met a basic threshold of public viability anyway, and that should be a reasonable standard. From what I'm reading, to be fair, I don't know, I haven't seen every 50 states here, this would make New York just about the most stringent rules in the country for third-party viability. Again, I don't know if that's confirmed. Gotham Gazette has said just about as much. But having said that, Xochitl, what do you say to the proponents of this rule change? You say, look, you should meet that threshold or get off the stage, essentially.
I think that you're right, Evan. No other state in America requires a party to qualify for the ballot every 2 years. And in this moment when we actually need to be infusing our democracy with greater participation, to mobilize voters, especially marginalized voters, to fully participate in our democracy, to speak to people up and down the state across lines of difference and get them as active participants, we need to create more pathways, not fewer ones. And third parties are essential in bringing more people into the conversation and making sure the conversation reflects the aims of working people, of young people of color. And so the WFP believes that we play a really key role in that, and we are going to be running and chasing to ensure that the required number of voters do vote on the Working Families Party this year. We know that we have tremendous support, and we also know that the state had no business making it harder for people to participate in politics, making it more restrictive for organizations and organized bodies of people to play in the electoral sphere. That is fundamentally anti-democratic. And so even if we're doing our organizing, ensuring that voters have an opportunity to vote on our line and to defeat Donald Trump this year, we also want to make sure that our state is not making it harder for people to participate.
All right. And what's one more example of an issue on the state level that with WFP moving the issues in certain directions for Democrats, you can make more headway, you think, with Democrats and the political left if there's more votes on the WFP line? What's an issue that stands out to you?
Absolutely. I mean, we flipped the legislature blue in 2018 by unseating Democrats who were not standing with working people, right? The IBC conference and replacing them with bold and progressive champions. That then made climate protections possible. That made tenant protections possible. Even before that, we championed the first millionaire's tax. In this moment when we're seeing that the working people are absorbing all of the risk and the 118 billionaires in our state are being sheltered in this moment, we have to think about how do we ensure recovery for all. We have to beat back against austerity politics. And the New York Working Families Party has been doing that for decades. The millionaire's tax, rejecting the Rockefeller drug laws, delivering the first paid sick leave bill. That is a state that we want if New York State actually can stand out as a beacon for progressive change, as a place where working families are not pushed out, and there's actually opportunity for all of us who live here.
Xochitl Nemeca is the director of the Working Families Party in New York. Appreciate the time and the perspective. Thanks for making it for the program today.
It was a pleasure to be on with you. Everyone, go out and vote. Vote on the Working Families Party line. Appreciate the time.
And there's the director of the WFP in New York. So Alex White is a member of the Green Party and a candidate for office a number of times yourself. What do you say to Tom, who emailed to say he just doesn't even have patience for a conversation about third parties? Because it sounds to me like Tom has got year 2000 flashbacks. He's thinking of Florida. He's thinking of Ralph Nader. He's feeling like spoilers. You know, I mean, I'm using the term that others have used, and I know it can be a sensitive one. What would you say to Tom, Alex?
Does he realize that Hillary Clinton won New York by 1.7 million votes? Are you telling me that a couple hundred thousand people voting to preserve choice in New York State would actually switch the state to Donald Trump?
I think he's thinking more nationally.
Well, presumably. We're talking New York State here.
Yeah.
And each state, because of the way we do politics, each state has to be considered in its own. And because of the electoral vote, that's the way we actually count things. You know, winning New York by one vote and winning New York by 1.7 million votes gives you the exact same number of votes for president. So, you know, that argument is kind of spurious. But also, I remember, I've been around for a couple years, and I remember the election of 2004 being the most important election of my lifetime, and the election of 2008 being the most important election of my lifetime, the election of 2012 being the most important election of my lifetime, 2016 was so important to prevent Donald Trump. Every election seems to be so important that we can't possibly vote for any purpose other than to stop somebody. And yet, you know, would we be better off in Rochester without third parties? I don't think so at all. Would we be better in New York State? You know, I remember the 2009 gubernatorial election when Howie Hawkins started talking about fracking. And that helped spark a movement that ended up leading to Cuomo signing an executive order to prevent it in New York. I don't think that happens without a third party. And we're just not better off without them. And New York State is really safe. It's just not going to flip. So people should feel comfortable voting to preserve what's important here, and that is choice. After all, and I want to go back to the numbers, you know, third parties contested 5.5% of all elections in Monroe County. Republicans and Democrats contested each other only about 40%.
Okay.
So are we really better off with fewer contested elections? I just can't even imagine.
Lauren Hall, what do you say to Tom, who is feeling like this is not the time to be talking about third parties?
Well, again, I just want to sort of remind him of how we got into this mess in the first place, right? I mean, part of the reason that Americans ended up with the 2016 election was the two parties offered us very problematic candidates. And again, I think that there's, you know, the argument for the Electoral College, you know, the sort of safety of New York, I think is important. I've consistently voted for third parties, partially because I'm in New York, again, a relatively safe state. My vote doesn't actually make a difference in sort of slipping from one party to another. But I also vote because I actually don't think that elections should be carried out on the basis of negative partisanship. I shouldn't be voting, holding my nose and voting for one candidate who does not, and this is particularly true as a libertarian, the choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump for a libertarian was absolutely a choice between two evils. We knew a little bit more about one of them than the other, but both of them were awful. And so if you support limited, limited intervention overseas, less hawkish foreign policy, we have two wars that have killed over 500,000 people in other countries, just as a low number. No libertarian is going to look at that and think that the human cost of Hillary Clinton's presidential aspirations is going to be much less than Donald Trump. So, you know, again, I think the Working Families Party and the Green Party are in a slightly different position because they overlap with a fairly strong sort of proportion of the Democratic Party's goals. But I think the situation is very different for libertarians. And so at least from my perspective, we didn't have an option. There was no option in the 2016 election. The other piece of that, of course, is that, you know, if we had had stronger third parties, we may not have had the stranglehold that there might have been more ability for the Democrats, for example, to bring forward a candidate who more people could rally behind, particularly in the states that Clinton ultimately lost. So, again, I think, you know, I understand the concern of people like Tom. But again, it's sort of making this existential argument that prevents any kind of change from happening, right? If the two parties are the only thing that are standing between us and oblivion, Well, then maybe we actually do really need to rethink the entire system, because we're giving far too much power to these two political parties that crowd out all of the incredible innovation and diversity that is actually in existence in the electorate.
All right. Well, let's take some phone calls. And I have Assemblyman Mark Johns on the line, who is a Republican. But let's talk about third parties and how you see the rules on the state level, Assemblyman Johns. Go ahead.
I'll tell you what, Evan, good afternoon.
Yeah.
I know some of your panelists, Alex, and we've talked. But I'll tell you what, I'm pro-third party. And I want more thoughts and ideas. I don't want everybody, well, you're Democrat or Republican. You know, in reality, I'm actually an independent. I just happen to be registered as a Republican. And I go door to door to thousands of doors, and some people are registered Democrat. They don't sound like it. Others are registered Republican. They don't sound like typical Republicans. So I want more choices. When you take a look at some of the ballots out there, we have assembly and Senate districts where nobody's even running. I mean, what choice do you have? You have one Republican or one Democrat, and you can either vote for him or vote for no one. So, you know, more choices is better. I mean, would you go in a restaurant that only served one kind of meal? And I saw, actually, I have another bill, a campaign finance reform bill, which if I get reelected, it'll be introduced in January. And Alex knows about this. Let's give every party that's willing to stand up to a major party a government subsidy to run a campaign. How about that? Let's let them get the message out. I don't care if it's Howie Hawkins or the Libertarian candidate. You know, I'm backed by the Independence Party. That's the party that's none of the above. That's the party for term limits, campaign reform. You know what? The monopoly of both parties has given us the budget deficit, sending us into bankruptcy in New York and at the federal level. And both parties have been part and parcel of this whole charade.
Well, Assemblyman, I always appreciate the phone call. I don't know, Lauren Hall, how do you feel about government subsidy for parties?
Well, I
threw that to the Libertarian
like
first on purpose. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, as a Libertarian, of course, I think, you know, on principle, we're not in favor of public financing for elections. I think that the way that public financing laws are often structured incentivizes or protects certain parties or certain demographics at the expense of others. I think it's really easy to manipulate those kinds of laws. So from a Libertarian perspective, I think we are not, we're not in favor of those things. You know, again, I think I'd have to look at the specific law, see how it's structured, see how, you know, what kinds of incentives it creates. I think there would be an argument to be made that maybe you accept public financing temporarily until you can reach some kind of threshold. I mean, I think that, you know, the Libertarian Party is, when I talk to people about Libertarian ideas, very often they're surprised because they don't realize that that's a Libertarian idea. It seems much more sort of rational than they think.
What's an example?
And a lot of it.
What's an example?
Well, one of the really obvious ones is, I mean, if you look at sort of who's been in favor of criminal justice reform for decades and decades, right, it's been Libertarians. Libertarians believe that you should limit the coercive power of the state as much as humanly possible. And so limiting laws, including drug laws, right, laws that involve so-called victimless crimes, make sure that we are limiting the power of the state to coerce people. Things like civil asset forfeiture. How easy is it for the government to seize your property without due process? Libertarians have been arguing against that for years. But yet if you tell people that in most states, the state can sort of come along and seize your property in a variety of complicated ways, and you have almost no ability to push back, people are horrified. So the kinds of, even things like licensure and certification laws, Libertarian groups like the Institute for Justice they were absolutely crucial in a bunch of serious lawsuits protecting, for example, African hair braiders from insane state requirements that they are licensed as a barbershop, right? There's all of these ways. I think we look at sort of Libertarians as though they're, you know, wealthy white people who just want to keep their money. The vast majority of Libertarian policies help the most vulnerable among us, because the most vulnerable among us are actually the ones who are chafing under under the coercive government regime. So prison reform, criminal justice reform, all of those things. But again, if you don't have a robust party system, it's very hard to explain to people that this is the actual platform that you're defending.
Well, and Lauren, I will just follow the Assemblyman's point by saying, you know, when he goes door to door and he says, you know, some people self-identify as Democrats. They don't sound like Democrats. They say they're Republican. They don't necessarily sound like a Republican. We have stereotypes for what that means. And I do think there's some merit to pointing that out, because when we talk about right and left, or people say, well, the media is on the left, the left includes Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Cory Booker, all the way to Bernie Sanders, Democratic Socialists mm-hmm. of America, who loathe the Democrats. I mean, the mm-hmm. left—the left is very diverse right now and has a wide range of views on everything from health care and taxation, economic structures and systems. The right is, I'm sure, has—it's a little less diverse right now, given the fact that more than 90% of Republicans are loyal to the president, and the Republican Party chose not to have a platform delineated with actual ideas this year. But I'm sure there's mm-hmm. diversity on the political right as well. And I think that we have to be careful not just to say right, left, as if it means one small, narrow frame of things or one other narrow frame of mm-hmm. things. But maybe, Professor Hall, that's the point of third parties, is to help flesh that out. Is that fair?
Exactly. Yes. And I think, I mean, again, I think your comment from earlier that we often sort of characterize libertarians as Republicans light is just a preposterous misunderstanding of what the Libertarian Party actually stands for. And so thinking about our political spectrum not as a linear spectrum between right and left, but in fact, I mean, the way that I teach students about it is a kind of quadrant, right? There's a lot of room for diversity. There's a lot of room for, and there's actually an enormous number of ways in which progressive folks and libertarian folks, for example, could team up on a lot of really crucial kinds of policy issues. Questions like basic minimum income, criminal justice reform, police reform, all of these kinds of things. But it's easier to do that within a party framework than it is if you just have isolated citizens trying to sort of figure out what the right position is for their policies, right? So if I found out that there's a libertarian candidate who was working closely with the Green Party on criminal justice issues, I would be ecstatic. But I can't do that if the parties don't have support and if they're not even on the ballot.
Alex White, what do you make of Assemblyman Johns' comments there about state support, even state subsidy for third parties?
Well, again, the devil will be in the detail. I've talked with them about it. It sure sounds a whole lot better than the plan that we are going to have in 2024, which is basically going to multiply the difference between candidates by six and make it almost impossible to unseat someone. Not that it's easy, you know, it just doesn't happen at the moment, and they're going to make it harder. And, you know, I think that we have been allowing in America votes to be bought, and allowing big money interests and organization interests to override public interest. And we are not better for that.
Well, let's do this then. Let's take our only break of the hour, and we've got some phone calls and emails to take as we talk third parties with Alex White from the Green Party. Professor Lauren Hall is a professor of political science at RIT. We were joined earlier this hour by the director of the Working Families Party in New York, and we're talking about New York State rules, the new election rules, which, according to some political observers, could really make this state the most stringent in the country for third parties and be a kind of poison pill for political parties like the Greens, like Libertarians, based on how many votes or percentage of votes they received this year. It is a very big threshold now, different than it used to be. Let's take that break and we'll come back to your feedback next. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, Vice President Mike Pence, Senator Kamala Harris, debating in the VP debate, their only debate of this election season. And more than most recent presidential election years, the vice presidential debate pits what could be two presidential contenders against one another. We're going to talk to Democrats and Republicans about the future of their party Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Yep, we'll be talking about the debates, but Joe Jorgensen, who is on the ballot as a Libertarian, not going to be on stage with Donald Trump and Joe Biden for the last two debates. The vice presidential candidate for the Libertarians won't be there. Lauren Hall, if they're on the ballot, should they be on the debate stage?
Yeah. I mean, the American people generally want greater diversity in the debates. We've seen this in poll after poll. They want greater viewpoint diversity. This is, by the way, a conversation that's happening in academia as well, right? We have sort of a variety of people who have a certain degree of a monopoly on the kinds of viewpoints that the public has access to. So if you're on the ballot, you should be on the debate, on the debate stage. And I think this gets into the question of, it's not just about state laws, right? It's also about the way that third parties are treated by a variety of different kinds of institutions in the U.S. system. So we have the Federal Elections Commission that looks at that limit for federal funding. We have the Commission on Presidential Debates, which requires 15% in polling. And then, of course, you have ballot access at the state level, which is what we've been talking about. And what all of that does is it reduces the ability of third parties to build these deep benches that they need to have. So this has been a huge debate within the Libertarian Party in terms of, do you focus on the presidential debate with people like Gary Johnson, people who have held public office at the state level? Or do you work on building these benches with a lot of high quality local candidates? Well, the problem is, in order to identify and attract really high quality candidates, there has to be a goal for them, right? So no one's going to run on the Libertarian ticket knowing that the state is going to squash their political ambitions, and they're going to have to hold their nose and choose to run as a Democrat or a Republican, or maybe as an independent. Of course, they're not going to go very far in that direction either. So all of these, it's not just about sort of access for the candidates that exist. It's about how these current laws at the state and federal level squash the pipeline of qualified principal candidates who could provide an alternative to the current two-party monopoly. And we're not getting robust conversations about the kinds of issues most Americans care about that actually affect most Americans because of the incentives of those two parties to keep that stranglehold intact. So, again, it's not just state laws, it's federal laws and how we prevent that kind of diversity from even emerging.
Alex White, do you want to see the debate stage widen on the national level?
I don't think we'd be worse off for that. I watched part of the last debate. Could it be worse to let more people up there?
Don't make me laugh at this.
But it actually is. I mean, I find the whole situation ridiculous. You know, you're asking the question if having more ideas on a public stage about our country would be a bad idea, would be a good or a bad idea. Well, how do you think it's a bad idea?
Yeah, I just don't understand the
argument against it. Yeah,
my view is immaterial here, but I agree with you on this one, Alex.
Yeah, I know, except for the fact that this is not about the two major parties are not about providing what's best. They're about control. They're about maintaining in power and in control. They're about keeping jobs for their institutional people. They're all about getting the money to allow them to build an infrastructure to keep winning. Okay, and they do have to occasionally do something that's good for the country, but that's not their primary purpose. Their primary purpose is to remain in power. And you look at the Republican Party not even putting a platform up. I mean, that's so irrelevant to them that they couldn't even be bothered to fake one. You know, if you think about that, you know, the idea that most Americans want to have a discussion about what would be good or bad for our country. They want there to be a vibrant marketplace of ideas, and, you know, not letting candidates with ideas on the stage allows us to have the sort of debate that we had a couple weeks ago.
All right. Back to your phone calls, and this in Rochester. This is Bob next. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for this interesting discussion. I think an important electoral reform that would advance the idea of having a wider spread view of ideas and give more support to third parties while still addressing Tom's issue of what you might call wasted votes, is the ranked choice voting. So if that was there, for instance, in Florida in 2000, and of the many thousands who voted for Ralph Nader had put in their second choice, which perhaps many of them would have been Al Gore, then that would have resolved that. And as Tom is saying, this is an important election. People could vote for whatever candidate they want first, which would in turn strengthen the votes that that party would get. But if it wasn't the winner, then those second votes would go to the person that we would, that that person would want. And as that distilled down, it would produce a winner, but it would allow people the freedom to vote more third parties, and it eventually could become something like a European system where there are many parties that are all viable and have a wider spread base of ideas in the government.
That's an interesting point, Bob, and I appreciate the phone call because it certainly underscores the notion that when you talk to voters, voters are increasingly likely to say that the two major parties, quote, don't represent me or don't understand what we need, et cetera. And Bob is essentially saying this is a system, ranked choice voting, which could give people a lot more options and might even change some of the outcomes, not necessarily but not necessarily a third party winning, but changing an outcome from an R to a D or a D to an R based on an order of preference. How many people who are going to vote for Joe Biden would put Donald Trump number two on a list of Joe Jorgensen, Howie Hawkins, even their cat? I mean, Donald Trump may not be number two for Joe Biden voters. I do suspect, just given the basic polling, that Biden is more likely to be number two for some Trump voters than Trump is to be number two for Biden voters. And that could impact the kind of outcome here. And I'm not simply saying we should get more Democrats in office. I mean, this just happens to be an election that would probably favor the challenger and not the incumbent. But there will be other elections where it goes another way. But let's ask our guests here if they see ranked choice voting as not only a possible benefit to voters, but also a way to be fair to the value that third parties might bring. Alex White?
Huge fan of ranked choice voting, and Maine has it this year in the presidential election, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how that works out in Maine.
Okay. Lauren?
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about the sort of deep irony that the Supreme Court just yesterday cleared away a Republican challenge to ranked choice voting in Maine. You know, so why are the parties, especially the Republicans in Maine particularly, so scared of ranked choice voting? Well, because it threatens the stranglehold that the parties have over political diversity in that state. There are concerns on a practical level about how, you know, I mean, a lot of this, I think the concern over ranked choice voting comes down to questions of practice and how it actually, I know there in some areas that have ranked choice voting, both at home and abroad, there's a lot of confusion on the ballots. Voters often don't understand the ballots. So I think those are sort of hurdles that you have to get over before you can just fully sort of implement a ranked choice system. But I think it's certainly true that it helps third parties. And like Alex said, I would like to see some of the data. I'd like to see how it works in practice. And that's, again, one of the sort of benefits of federalism is that we get to see how different states, trying out these new voting systems, you know, how they would work. But I think ranked choice voting has a lot of potential to undermine those the sort of two major political parties.
Well, Professor Hall, if Americans are so dissatisfied with politics, and they are, and if they are turned off by the two major political parties, which they often say they are, who do you blame for American voters who almost never vote third party?
Well, there's two usual explanations for that. The first is the structure of the Constitution itself. So we have winner-take-all elections, which means that over time, diversity gets weeded out of, even if you start with a lot of political parties. I mean, we saw this as early as the election of 1800, you all of a sudden have sort of two parties or two main parties emerge. And a lot of that has to do with voter preferences. So there's a sort of, you don't want to necessarily vote for the underdog, consistently at least. And so Americans do tend to, you know, prioritize their votes in ways that they think will actually sort of make a difference. So ranked choice voting would eliminate some of that hurdle. So it's still a winner-take-all system in the sort of way that the actual outcome of the election works. But the actual election itself wouldn't be winner-take-all, right? So you would actually have the ability to count those second-choice votes. So that's sort of the first thing. But the second piece of it is I think, much more pernicious. And it's essentially that we have a system of regulatory capture where Americans are prevented from accessing options and therefore don't realize that those options exist. So again, if you look at the makeup of the Federal Election Commission, if you look at the makeup of the Commission on Presidential Debates, and you look at the burdens that they've placed on third parties, it doesn't make sense. I mean, Americans look at third parties as irrelevant because the main two parties have made third parties irrelevant. And so, of course, especially when the stakes, and this is also, I think, a function of polarization. So as the sort of moral gulf between the two parties has grown, more and more Americans feel the way that Tom feels about elections, which is, if my party doesn't win this election, it's the end of the world. And so that makes people much less likely to want to support third parties. But if we had a more robust third party system, fewer Americans would feel that kind of existential desperation. So I think that there's a real chicken and egg argument here about how to get over the stranglehold that the two parties have on the actual policies that allowed third parties to enter. We essentially have a monopoly system. And then once you get rid of that stranglehold, you can have voter, you know, I think you'd have greater voter support. But again, it's going to be really hard to get that first reform in place unless we have third parties that do consistently well enough to challenge those monopolies. So it's a very hard thing to undo once you have the system that we have in place.
I like Alex White. If you want to weigh in on that, I want to give you room to do that. I also want to make sure, before we lose the hour, that we address Michael's email. He says, early in the hour, there was more discussion about the new third-party viability rules and the mechanics of how those rules became law. Would you consider circling back this information for some background that would be helpful for people who want to choose to write their representatives? Anything that would help listeners start on that would be appreciated. So, Alex, you want to reset for listeners like Michael why we're here and why you're concerned about the viability of third parties in the state. Go ahead.
Yeah. This started with a discussion of back in 2018, I believe, of public financing to elections, and they couldn't at Albany get together on this, so they appointed a commission. And that commission came up with the idea that we could do this public financing option by basically multiplying small donations by six. And that would solve all our problems. But that would be expensive. So one of Andrew Cuomo has had this really hate relationship with the Working Families Party for years. And he saw this as an opportunity to reduce the cost of public financing, look like he's doing something incredibly progressive, and simultaneously eliminate the minor parties, which have really been a bother to him. And he somehow feels threatened his political dominance. So this was passed. The commission did this, and court said it's questionable. It ended up the assembly got together after the Democrats took complete control of it and passed this. There are lawsuits pending on this at the moment. But the two ideas here that are bad and that are easy to attack in a letter to your representative are public financing, and that you multiply donations by six multiplies the gap between candidates by six, making it almost impossible for an underdog to upset someone. If the difference had been $50,000, this is going to make that difference $300,000 between the candidates. The second idea here is that, you know, this is basically reducing the choice as a result of the governor's personal vendetta against minor parties.
And what do you want people to do then, Alex?
Well, they can obviously write their representatives, but what I really want them to do is vote for a third party in this presidential election. You're in New York. It is very unlikely, and I want to say 0% chance, that it will flip from supporting the Democrat to supporting the Republican in the presidential election. So whether you feel you lean towards libertarians or towards Greens or just really progressive and recognize the fact that the Democratic Party doesn't represent you, the parties out there that do are third parties, and you can preserve them by voting for a third party.
Alex, I want to thank you for not only reaching out but making the time and explaining to listeners why so many who have supported third parties like WFP, like the Greens, like the Libertarian Party, and more, why it matters. We've got supporting emails from listeners on ranked choice and a lot of ideas. I think it's generated a lot of thought here. Alex is a member of the Green Party and a candidate for office a number of times. Thanks for making time for the program, and it's always good to talk to you, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
And Professor Lauren Hall, who is an associate professor of political science at RIT. Thanks for making us think as always, Professor, and I know it's busy for you. Thanks for making it work on the program.
Thanks. It's always a pleasure, Evan.
You got it. And the director of the Working Families Party in New York is Sochi Nemeka. She joined us earlier this hour as well. Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.